heard of the young child that was cringing in his bedroom during a storm. The mother came up and said, "Dear, just trust in God." And he said, "I want someone with skin on." Jim and I dined with several families this last weekend, and there was a very fine young woman there that we'd known most of her life. And at the meal table, she said, "Why doesn't God show himself?" He showed himself on Sinai and Abraham and Moses. "Why doesn't God show himself?" The father had asked her to bring up the topic. He was a minister. Asked to bring up the topic when we came. And then at the other end of the table was a scientist. He said, "We scientists think of God as all brain, counting, numbering, weighing, measuring. But I want to know about his heart. Why doesn't God show himself? Why don't we see him as someone with skin? Does he really care?" The questions we think of all the time are those that Philip Yancey addressed in a recent book called Disappointment with God. Is God fair? Why is he silent? Why is he hidden? Constantly in the Old Testament you read about the hidden God. "Thou art a God that hidest thyself," Isaiah 45:18. Psalm 10:24. "Surely thou dost hide thyself," Psalm 10:1. "You're hiding God." Why does he hide? Why does he? Life would be so much easier if we could see him. We think. The first thing to say is that our knowledge of the world around us is somewhat of an illusion. We don't stop to think about it very often, but none of us really are in contact with the world around us in 100% way. All we have is impressions registered in this little computer on top of our shoulders. That's all we have. The only contact with outside is what our senses tell us inside here. You don't really see me. You see something inside your mind. You don't really feel the world. You just have an impression inside your mind. That's the first thing to remember. That where we think everything is clear and plain and straightforward, it isn't. If you're drunk or you're on drugs, your whole world changes. Even if you're tired, the world changes. So that's the first thing to remember. What we think is so clear isn't really. All you have is impressions within the mind mediated by your senses. If your senses are affected, the whole world changes. Secondly, the one place where we really get inside the universe, everything we know is exterior, including other people. But the one place where we really get inside the universe is inside ourselves. There we know there's a person. This is the only place where we can put our finger on absolute reality and say we know it. Bruce Barton was a businessman who lived during the 1920s when the world was changing religiously and creeds were being thrown out the window. And he wrote a book, What Can a Man Believe? He said, "Well, I can believe that I exist. And I can believe that I think." The philosopher said that, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. He said, "I know I think. What I think changes the world around me." Thirdly, he says, if the universe has produced me a person who thinks, the universe at its heart must be personal and have a mind. And furthermore, he said, I know that I want for the best for people. I want the fair to win. I want the right to be superior. So if I have it, whatever produced me must have it. Then he said, if you were God, would you put people through all the trials and troubles of life to develop character and then throw it on the scrap heap? No, he said, we can know there's a life to come. So there was his summary of what we can easily know. We know that we exist, we know that we think, we know we have values, convictions of right and wrong, therefore the universe that produced us must have all of those qualities. It must be personal, it must have a mind, and it must have a heart. And it must plan eternity. Because there's just no sense in training, in schooling, In disciplining lies lay the veil of character and then throwing it away. But there's a better clue still in Ecclesiastes chapter 3 verse 11 that says he set eternity in their hearts. Some versions have world, but the Hebrew word olam means eternity. Everywhere else that's its meaning, eternity. He has set eternity in their hearts. Why do I mention that? Do you know how they discovered Pluto? Back in the days when they discovered it, they thought it was the outermost planet of the solar system. And they found that Neptune was suffering perturbations. It was moving irregularly because there was a pull on it from somewhere. And they said it has to be that there's another planet beyond Neptune that's pulling on it. Well, you and I have immortal longings. We suffer perturbations of the heart. Because God has set eternity in our souls, like Neptune, we feel these immortal longings that point to something invisible but real. You know the illustration I've used before, C.S. Lewis gives it. The fish never complain of the water, and birds never complain of the air. But you and I are always complaining about time, in which we're immersed as thoroughly as birds in the air, and fish in the sea. We always complain about time. There's not enough of it. It's going too slowly. It's going too fast. I think it was Einstein that said, 2 hours with a beautiful girl only seems a moment, but 1 minute sitting on a hot stove feels an eternity. He said, that's relativity. That's relativity. Yeah. When you face reality, there's so much that is irregular and uncertain and changing, like the spokes on the wheel. But there is this axle that the heart is drawn to something beyond itself and beyond the world. We do have these immortal longings. It's true, there are some souls that get so weary they just want to lie down and die forever. But that's not the real thing. Most of us want life, a life that will measure with the life of God. We are so finite and we experience what's been called the polarities of life. The paradoxes that confront us with every hour of conscious existence. For example, there's the possibilities of life versus the facts. We all have dreams, ambitions, but they're often countered out by the facts that can't be changed. Facts are stubborn things. And many of our desires, our hopes, our plans, our attempts, they founder on the facts. That's the first polarity of life. My desires versus the facts. The second polarity is rationalism versus irrationalism. We want to behave rationally, but there's a lot in us that's not rational. Step on my toe and you'll find out. This sort of thing. There's so much in us that's bubbling up, that has tremendous strength. It's passion and emotion. And yet we know that these, unless controlled by reason, can destroy. So there's the next polarity. Reason versus emotion. Rationalism versus irrationalism. There's the community versus the individual. I want some things, but is it good for the community? We all face that. The thief thinks he wants money, but going around thieving doesn't help the community. There's responsibility versus impotence. I know I should always be kind, but I'm not. I know I should always think optimistically, but I don't. I know I should ever be unselfish, but I'm naturally selfish. Things I would, I do not. The things I would not, those I do, says Paul. Meaning that he ever feels drawn to the evil, though in his innermost self he rejoices in the good. So there's responsibility versus impotence. And then there's the lasting versus the temporal. It's a natural feeling that life will always be as it is today, but we know it's not true. Life won't always be as it is. We will never meet again just like this. Not ever. There's the lasting versus impotence. Why doesn't God reveal himself as someone with skin on? Why doesn't he come and show himself? Why the hidden God? Have you ever thought about it? You can only see the stars well if you're in the dark. Don't hope by looking out the window of a well-lighted room that you're going to see the heavens as they are. You can't. but go out where there are no street lights, no house lights. Then you can see them. As a matter of fact, even by day, if you're down in a deep pit, you can see the stars by day. Why do I mention this natural illustration? It takes a certain amount of darkness to see God, the Son of Righteousness. Isaac Newton set up a scientific arrangement whereby he could see a reflection in a mirror of the sun, and he gazed at it, and then he was blind for 3 days. We can only stand so much. Because of our finitude and because of our sinfulness, we can't tolerate pure light. The eternal stars shine out bright enough when it's dark enough. It applies to God and it applies to truth. The main truths we learn in pain. The things most worth knowing never come in happiness. They come from sadness. There's nothing on life worth anything that comes easily. And the knowledge that's most valuable, the knowledge of God and truth, that's the most expensive knowledge. It takes pain. Annie Dillard is quoted in Paul Yancey's book, and she said this: "You don't have to sit outside in the dark. If, however, you want to look at the stars, you'll find darkness is required. The stars neither require it nor demand it." Would it help if we could see God with skin? Would it really help? They saw him in the days of the Exodus. And what a bunch of cantankerous, stubborn, ungrateful rebels these people who saw God proved to be. Does power compel love? You see, love complicated even the life of God. It complicates everybody's life. Love always complicates things because it looks for the best. Love can never be brought about by power, by force. In a concentration camp, they could and did make people eat excrement, kill their brothers and bury them, curse their mothers, deny God. Power in a concentration camp could do all those things. Power couldn't make the people love the Nazis. There's a limit to what power can do. God doesn't unveil all his power because it wouldn't achieve what he most wants, our love. Think of it right through the Old Testament times. Even in Eden, God wasn't always visible. Otherwise, Eve would never have taken that piece of fruit. The promise comes to Abraham, and then God doesn't talk to him for 25 years. 25 years, not 25 minutes. 25 years. And when Abraham's 99, the Lord comes again. He says, "Abraham, now's the time." And Abraham says under his breath, "Well, Lord, you certainly took your time. 25 years, I'm 99. My wife have a baby?" And you know, God who promised that from Abraham would come a seed as numerous as the stars, not only Abraham's wife was barren, his son's wife was barren, and his son's wife was barren. When you get to the end of Genesis, there's 400 years gap before Exodus and deliverance from Egypt. 400 years, that's twice as long as USA has existed since independence. Twice as long! God seems great at dragging his heels, or is it that he's so much the eternal one that time doesn't register with him as it does to us? But anyway, here's a God that reveals himself. It almost seemed a God that had skin on, and it didn't work. The mighty acts of the 10 plagues, the 10 commandments proclaimed with power, and then in the book of Numbers you have 10 great rebellions of the people that saw a God with skin on. It didn't work. It didn't work. Power cannot force love. Power, in a sense, robs us of the freedom, and the essence of love is freedom. There's a choice involved. There's an attitude involved. That's freedom. Where there's power, it robs freedom. Look with me at a passage, please, in 1 Kings chapter 18. chapter 19, I'm sorry. 18, you remember, is the great conflict with the priests of Baal by Elijah. This man who brings down fire from heaven and water from heaven. And then I love the next chapter, chapter 19. All the heroes of the Bible not only have feet of clay, they're clay all through. And the man in the Bible is revealed as strong only if God holds him up. And the same is true today. A man or a woman is only strong in today's world while God permits them to be so. And I like chapter 19 of Kings because the mighty Elijah loses heart, becomes depressed, wants to die, and I'm glad to find he's so human. Because that's part of human experience too. The person who has never felt down, who's never felt discouraged, can't be altogether normal. Normal life involves downs as well as ups, discouragement as well as encouragement, weakness as well as strength, failure as well as success. This is normal life. This is why we need God so much. Look, please, here in 1 Kings 19, verses 11 and 12. You remember what happened? All the nation of Israel shouted, "Yahweh, He is God." When they saw the fire came down and the waters came down, they said, "Yahweh is God." And Elijah's thinking, "Great, now Ahab will get rid of Jezebel, all the idols will be thrown down, righteousness will prevail, they'll all do what's holy." And instead he gets a message, "Elijah, you get out of here, I'm going to kill you." And to his amazement, there's no revival. There's no reformation. There's no transformation. All the signs, all the evidence of power has failed. And he's so discouraged he runs away. He doesn't want to live in a land where people are like that. So he runs and runs and runs and tells us that in the beginning of chapter 19. Verse 4 says he asks he might die. And I love that passage because in every human life that happens. Psychiatrists tell us that every normal person has contemplated suicide by the age of 40 at least once. At least once. That's why whenever you're tempted in that or any other negative decision, you should always postpone the actual fulfillment of your decision. And in postponing the fulfillment, you will prevent the fulfillment. Because whatever your feelings are now, they will shortly be changed into another thing. You never, ever should act immediately on a negative decision. You should always give it time. It'll be the difference between life and death. Well, the Lord is very compassionate. Here he is under the juniper tree in verse 4, asking to die. And in verse 5, an angel touches him and gives him a meal. Provides for him food and water. And he comes a second time and urges him to have another meal. And then he's moved to go to Horeb with the Mount of God, where God revealed himself in power. And now God talks to him. Please observe what it says in 11 and 12. He said, "Go forth and stand on the mount before the Lord." This is a discussion after the discussion between the Lord and Elijah about what's happened. And the Lord gives him a demonstration of power. Verse 11, "The Lord passed by a great and strong wind, rent the mountains, broke in pieces the rocks." The Lord wasn't in the wind. "And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, and the Lord was not in the fire." I love storms. I was born in one. Whenever there's a really good storm, I love it. Where I was brought up in the tropics of Queensland, 9 months of the year you could plan a picnic and it would never rain. 3 months you didn't plan it, it rained every day, almost. The monsoons, glorious, the heavens black. The water comes down, not little drops, artificial rain like in some parts of other great countries, but came down in bucketfuls, and I loved it. But you know, the Lord isn't always in the things that are most stimulating to the senses. The things that appeal to us immediately and get us emotionally involved are not always the best things. His power, power unlimited. Strong wind that breaks the mountains, rends the rocks, earthquake, fire. And each time it says, but the Lord was not in it. The Lord was not in it. And after the fire, still small voice. The Hebrew says, the gentle sound of stillness. There's a verse in the book of Isaiah that says, in quietness and in confidence shall be thy strength. Apparently, God speaks best when things are quiet, when things are calm, when things are still. When all the layers of experience that the senses pile upon us are temporarily interrupted, and then we can hear. After the fire is still small voice. This was a pattern of the way God was going to deal in the future. Because after Elijah, the later prophets don't work miracles. Now remember, Elijah worked about 7 mighty miracles, and Elisha, who asked for a double portion of his spirit, worked 14. But after this phenomenon of Elijah and Elisha proclaiming and evidencing the power of God, after that, the prophets don't have it. Isaiah doesn't work miracles. Habakkuk, Haggai, Zephaniah, Jeremiah, they're no longer in the miracle doing business. Certainly not in the same way as Elijah and Elisha. We have about 21 miracles in a very short time. But after this phenomenon, where God displays his power and it's fruitless, and men are taught the change doesn't come that way, they must learn to listen on the quiet, or they'll miss the best. That's a solemn thing, isn't it? If you don't have times of quiet, you'll miss the best. Not an accident sometimes when we're compelled by a broken leg or something to lie still a while. It's good for us to be still. We'll miss the best if we're not still. And so God is saying by this parable, all right, Elijah, you and Elisha are going to show my power, but after that, there won't be any earthquakes. There won't be any fire coming down from God out of heaven. From here on, it's going to be a quiet voice. Just words and the Spirit. And so that's all you get. See, this man lives about 900 BC. A century and a half later, comes along Isaiah. Works no miracles. Another century and a half goes by, and along comes Jeremiah. He's not in the miracle-doing business. And so it goes on, and then suddenly the prophets run out, and the voice stops. And there's 400 years of solemn stillness and no verbalizing at all from Malachi to John the Baptist. And then the Son of God comes. Do you notice the consistency of how God chooses to reveal himself most times? It's usually both a revelation and a hiddenness. Never deny the stars' constellations because of the dark patches. You know, we can be very selective in the way we view truth. And people can look up at the heavens and say, what are all those dark spaces doing up there? Never deny the constellations because of the dark spaces. The fact is, all of life is irradiated by the hidden God. All of human experiences, wherever you have truth, wherever you have love, wherever you have mercy, wherever you have forgiveness, there you have God. God is always present and God is always hiding. God is present in the Christian church. Oh, what a hiding is that? Because the church is no art gallery, it's a hospital. God is present in the sacraments of baptism and the Lord's Supper, but I only see water and bread and grape juice. But he's there. He's there. And in my experience from day to day, I cry out for the hidden God to show himself. And despite my unbelieving heart, he is there. That's why I still breathe and see and think. Who can explain the mystery of a heart that begins to beat? Who can explain the mystery of thought? No surgeon exploring the mind has ever said, ha-ha, I've got it, here's a thought. Oh no. Those that want to see everything before they can believe in it have never seen their own brains. They have one. God is always present and God is always hidden. It was so at the burning bush. It was so in the cloud that overshadowed Israel. It was so in the sanctuary. And finally, it was so in the man of Galilee, the man of Nazareth. He was just a man in appearance. But he was the God-man, and never did hyphen mean so much. The God-man. Kierkegaard tells a story, the great Danish philosopher, about a king who fell in love with a commoner. And he's bewildered. What shall I do? Shall I send the armies to take her from her parents' house, bring her to the palace, put a queen on her head, dress her in beautiful clothes? I can compel her to come, but will she love me? Or I can go out riding, accompanied by my troops, dress splendidly as king, and take her by the hand and put her up in the chariot with me and bring her back, but will she love me? So what does he do? He disguises himself as a commoner. He woos her as one who has nothing. And thus he gains her love. You know why Kierkegaard tells the story. That's what God did. Being made in the form of God, he counted not a thing to be grasped after, to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation and took on him the form of a man and humbled himself unto death, even the death of the cross. Remember the disciples once said, Lord, should we call down fire from God out of heaven like Elijah did? Christ made it clear he wasn't in that business. Remember Christ told them on another occasion, don't you know I could ask for 12 legions of angels? You and I would grab that. We could use those legions often. But Christ apparently wasn't in the business. He was God, but hidden. God, but hidden. And never was he so much hidden as on the cross. You imagine, a blink of the eye could have destroyed all the soldiers. Could have burnt up all of Jerusalem. Save thyself. He saved others himself. He cannot save. He cannot save himself, not because he lacks the power, but because he loves too much. Think of it. How does God get across to finite, sinful human beings? He abdicates. He gives freedom. Freedom to do wrong, such as every parent must give to growing children. God, in a sense, trembles as he takes risks. And then, in all nakedness of his assumed form, he invites mankind in his weakness. What a picture. What a picture. When God chose to create, he chose limitation. We do that. You choose a pencil, you choose black and white. When Michelangelo chose paint and a certain type of ceiling, he limited himself. When God made the world, he limited himself. You and I long for him to intervene visibly, tangibly. We want the earthquake. Lord, come down and stir things up. We want the mighty wind to blow away the evil. We want the fire to scorch and destroy what is bad. We want a God with skin on that would rob us of our freedom. And it could never evoke our love. There'll be many times in this year when you and I long for the intervention of God. I can only say to you that wherever we have a completed picture of God's dealing in any one case, it always makes sense. Here's Job. Even his wife says, curse God and die. His friend said, you must have done something very naughty, Job, to be in this fix. Life is not worth living for Job. But by the end of the story, it's fine. It's fine. He gets back double of everything, except the children, because he's going to get them in the resurrection. Joseph. No sin recorded against Joseph. But look at the trouble he's in. In the pit, stripped, sold for pieces of silver. Falsely accused, down in the dungeon. He helps people. They forget about him. Remember me when you're with Pharaoh, he says. But the chief butler didn't remember Joseph, but forget him. It's a terrible story, but it comes out all right. It comes out all right. Wherever you see God complete his dealings, it's fine. See, we're girt about by time. God's not in time. He's like the author of a book. He's outside the book. But you and I are in the book. We're within the margins. We're so close to things, they're out of proportion. We don't see the full story. Wherever we see God's full dealings in any situation, it's always good. It's always good. Even Calvary. We've often talked about the old preacher that said, that was Friday, but Sundays are coming. That was Friday. Sundays are coming. My friends, we'll never in this life have the overwhelming power of rationality, demonstration, sensory interpositions, so it's no longer an effort to believe. It'll never happen in this life. It would rob us. It would take away our freedom. It could never evoke love. But if you look for him in the darkness, he'll shine. An old lady once said to an agnostic, I know the Bible's true. God's told me. Madam, how did God tell you? He told me, she said. Don't believe it, he said. Well, do you believe in the sun and the sky? Yes, I believe it, said the agnostic. How do you know it's up there? It warms me. It gives me light. He said, that's how the Bible has told me. That it's from God. It warms my heart. It lights my way. But the Bible finds its pinnacle at the cross of Christ, where the righteous died for the unrighteous, the just for the unjust, the good for the evil, where the Lord God Almighty, who made sun and moon and stars, and all the constellations of creation, humbled himself. There God spoke his last word. It's an evil and adulterous generation that seeks for a sign. No greater sign could be given than God dying for sinners. The God who justifies the ungodly is the greatest paradox the human mind can conceive of. If we're not humbled by it, if we're not awed by it, nothing can help us. The reason God does not now appear to proclaim the Ten Commandments, to have a judgment day over the big cities of the world, is he has spoken his last word in Jesus Christ. If that doesn't convince us, dear friends, nothing can convince us. I invite you through this year, when the going is tough, to think how tough it was on the cross. You see, your trouble and mine is we expect life to be easy. Life will never be easy in a sinful world. It will never be easy. If we could reconcile ourselves to the fact that life is essentially difficult. Scott Peck, when he began a book some years ago, began with the three words, life is difficult. If you know that from the start, life becomes easier. You're told you've got to go to a certain place, and one man says, huh, there'll be a prison there. Another man says, huh, for someone of my standing, it'll be a palace. When they get there, it's neither a prison nor a palace. The man that expects the palace is disappointed. It's just a first-class hotel. The man who expects a prison is excited. This is wonderful. My friends, this year you go and I go, whither we know not. None of us know what the year holds. Believe the paradoxical truths. Life is difficult, but the yoke of Christ can make it easy. Because when you take the yoke of Christ, you know that the most real being in your world and in the universe is a being of infinite love and infinite wisdom and infinite condescension. And we can walk the days however difficult, we can endure the pain however awful, if we know we are loved and we are accepted, and that ultimately all will be well. all will be very well. For our Christ does all things well. Let us pray. Thank you, Lord, for the cross. Your last word, a word so wonderful, a word so far-reaching, a word that echoes into the hidden depths of every soul. Thank you for that word. Incline our hearts to believe it, to know that we are loved, that we are loved infinitely, that we are loved warts and all, that we too can be accepted in the Beloved and complete in Him. Grant us that assurance as we walk the days of this new year.